So people from Wisconsin are like super proud that they're from Wisconsin. Have you noticed that? Like some of us, I'm from Long Island. I don't really tell people. And when I asked our next speaker, Gar, what he wanted me to say about him, the only thing he really wanted me to say is, make sure you tell them I'm from Wisconsin. Born in Racine, went to school here at the University of Wisconsin, and he's had an amazing career. This is somebody who's done everything from being a historian, political economist, activist, writer, government official, currently a professor at the University of Maryland, a prolific writer. His most recent books are What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution and America Beyond Capitalism. Who likes those titles? His articles have appeared in everything from mainstream places like Washington Post, New York Times, LA Times, to all kinds of alternative press. He's a lecturer on the lecture circuit as well as a commentator on television. He has been in the inside testifying before Congress. He was a legislative director in both houses of Congress. We won't hold that against you, Gar. And a special assistant in the State Department. And he doesn't just speak and write. He's actually developing practical paths towards ecologically sustainable, community-oriented change. I've heard him speak a number of times, and each time I learn something new that really sticks with me in thinking about what kind of future do we want, what kind of future are we building, and how can we get there. So let's give a big hand to our keynote speaker tonight, Gar Alperovitz.
Thank you, dear. Hard to follow that gal. She's so terrific. It's really great to be back in Wisconsin. It just brings back the feelings of the life and the politics. And I was Gaylord Nelson's legislative director, so those of you who are involved in the environment, that was what the comment about one of our senators founding Earth Day. That was long ago. I was also doing policy planning in the State Department till the Vietnam War and left at that time. And since then, I've been, as Medea said, asking myself a question I want to ask you all tonight. And I have an answer for myself, which I'm going to offer to you as a suggestion to let it sit in your lap like a brick and look at it and see, do you really believe that? And the suggestion is that it is possible that we together can in fact transform the most powerful corporate capitalist system in the history of the world, and that it is possible to create a system beyond corporate capitalism and beyond state socialism in the real world. Now, I say that and suggest let it sit there in your lap and look at it, because in my experience, most people don't really allow themselves to believe that. They work hard on issues. They develop new projects. They are seriously committed. And they don't quite believe, now this is not everybody, that we actually can change the system. Really. And my suggestion to you is not that it's inevitable, but that we live in a period of time when that possibility actually is opening up before us. And the question, there is never certainty, but the question is whether we can rise to the level of grasping that possibility really, and then act upon it with intensity and clarity and make it happen. Now, you have to remember, I'm also a historian and a political economist, so I think in historical terms. My heroes, and this is one way to get at the larger question I'm raising, my heroes are people like the people in Mississippi who fought for civil rights in the 1930s and 40s. That's when the really hard work was done. I take nothing away from the 60s and the 50s. But the people who understood that the fight begins then, when you could easily, and certainly were many, many people tortured and hung and killed in the 30s and 40s, what they were actually doing was systematically establishing the groundwork without which what came later probably was not possible. So when I speak about transforming the system, and I am speaking to the person in your seat and mine, the question is whether we can see ourselves actually not doing projects, we have to do projects, not doing protests, we have to do protests, not doing all the things that are necessary, but actually continually raising ourselves to the question, are we about changing the system, and what does it mean, and how do we do it today, tomorrow, now? And that we can do that. I don't see people nodding, I don't see people shaking their head, but I know people doubt that, even very committed activists. So let me come at it another way. Here's a question for you. When the day of the revolution comes, will the person that day who is working to make it happen have done more or less than the person, like the person in Mississippi in the 1930s? Or was it just the time happened to be different? It counts every day from here to there just as much as that moment when the transformation occurs. And the sense of power empowerment that comes with that, I think, is critical to where we go and how we get there. I'm going to say one other way to get at it, and then perhaps say a couple other things that are illustrating the argument a little differently. It was mentioned that all the labor law changes that occurred in Wisconsin and Social Security that occurred in other states and many other things in the decades before the New Deal were in fact developed by people in rooms like this around the country and many of them in this state in the prehistory of that event. And if you look at the women's movement in the 19th century, where the ultimate goal was getting the vote, over decade by decade, state by state by state by state, and then they overcame and in fact achieved the result. And they created that revolution. I want to suggest to you that we are living in a peculiar time when this system is in an odd form of decay. And it opens up to us the possibility of seeing ourselves as actually laying the foundations for a real transformation, not simply projects, not simply issues, not simply the varied fights, all of that of course, but that we may self-consciously, here's the hard part, self-consciously begin to rise to that level of seeing our power. Now why do I say that? Partly, I believe the system is in an odd form of decay that needs to be understood because it is forcing people to begin to act in new ways already because of its odd failures. Traditionally, the left, and certainly the Marxist left, believed the revolution would come when there'd be a massive collapse and there would be a takeover of power. My suggestion to you, possibly, certainly in this country, were that to occur, would probably go to the right, not the left. But I don't think it's going to occur that way. I think we live in a system that is peculiar in that it is stalemated, not only in Washington. It is in decay, and it is in difficulty in many, many areas, but it is unlikely to collapse in the traditional way. that, I'll suggest to you, opens a different possibility. Now, why do I say that? In the 1930s, government was 11% of the economy. It is now 30 to 35% of the economy. The Keynesian floor under the system is three times as big. It may dip seriously, but it's not likely to collapse in the way that the traditional idea went on. But it's also not likely to grow and develop. As we're seeing, there's a stalemate in the government. They can't move the money, and they can't handle the international competition, they can't handle the trade issues. So we get stagnation, decay, ripples, occasional up, occasional down, and slow building pain. That is an environment in which people build and learn and have time to see that something is fundamentally wrong. The latest polling data says that people under 30, these are the people who are going to build the next revolution, already favor the word socialism more than the word capitalism. That's a very interesting thing. But what's really interesting, if you ask why has that happened, it's because the system itself is teaching people that the idea of capitalism is one that you should abandon. It's a decaying process. They see the income distribution. They see the failures in the environment. They see the wars. They see the civil liberties decay. They see there are no jobs. They see themselves in debt. And they understand, this is a big deal, they understand there's something fundamentally wrong. It's not simply a political crisis. It's a systemic crisis. When that begins to dawn on people, and I think it is beginning to dawn on people, and that's part of maybe grasping that we are actually beginning to be in a position to think about transformation. When that begins to happen, people begin to ask much different questions than the kind that they usually ask in a political situation. In political situations, the question only is who do you elect and can you get a new policy through? When you begin to say there's something wrong with the system, then you're asking, can we restructure the whole thing somehow over time, no matter what, or we don't get answers to these trends. One way to understand that it is a systemic crisis, that it's producing pain, that is changing ideas, and I will suggest changing projects on the ground in very different ways. The way you can tell it's a systemic crisis, in many ways, but the most obvious is that the long, long, long trends don't change. They get worse no matter who's in office. It's not only about Republicans and Democrats. Over 30 to 35 to 40 years, in Democrat, Republican, didn't matter. The top 1% has gone from 10% of the income to roughly 20 to 22% in some years. And the trend goes on because it's being driven by underlying power relationships. CO2 production over 30 years, 30% increase. It matters in office. If you take the one I think people don't focus on often enough, liberties or civil liberties, you can talk about this in terms of who goes to jail, you can talk about it legally, but if you actually look at liberty, that fundamental American value, what you find is over 30, 35 years, the test of liberty is who loses it. And what's happened over 30 to 35 years is that the number in prison has gone from 93 per 100,000 up to 753 per 100,000, 8 times per capita more than any other nation in the world, including Russia and China, largely black and brown. But the trends are what you keep your eye on. It doesn't matter who's in power. And it tells you that something in the system needs changing or the trends don't change. We are entering a systemic crisis of a very odd kind that doesn't collapse, doesn't decay, but teaches people either you go in a new direction or the trends continue. And it's teaching people like those who produce this extraordinary convention, incredible numbers of people who are actually doing things on the ground and in many, many, many areas, that it's time to begin to get together and think differently about what we're doing and how we get there and who we are in the matter. I won't belabor that, but the question to ask in the mirror tomorrow morning as you look at that person opposite you, am I a historical actor or am I an activist? You got to be both. There's nothing wrong with activism, nothing wrong with that, but seeing that we actually have that power, potentially, is critical. What do I mean by changing the system? And what do we mean by changing the system? Systems, historically, are defined largely by who gets to control the wealth. That's where the power comes from. In feudal times, it was the lords and the church and the king who had the wealth, and it was land, and they had the power. In the Soviet Union, it was the state that had the wealth, and they had the power. In 19th century capitalism, very interesting, it was small business people and small farmers in a very odd populist form that had the wealth, very different from anything we now have. What we now have is the elites and the corporations controlling the wealth, and an odd form of semi-attempt to balance it. The top 400 people, some of you may know this number, every time I think about it, I can't quite get it. 400 persons, you could get them in the bottom part of this room, have more wealth now than the bottom 185 million Americans taken together. It is an extremely concentrated system of extreme concentration of power and the corporations they own. And it is a narrow group. They can do a lot with their money, and they can do a lot with their power, and they are doing a lot with their power, but they are also creating trends that are causing people to raise questions and act in different ways. So, if there is to be a next system, when we create it, as we create it now, it will have to alter who gets to own that capital. And what is interesting to me as a historian and political economist is that if you look below what the traditional media allows you to see, nobody reports on this. There is an extraordinary range of stuff going on around the country, a lot of it going to be talked about at this conference, which is actually beginning to build and transform and democratize the ownership of capital in a very down-home American, ordinary, practical way. This is not France with a centralized government having to do everything. We're Americans. You can roll up your sleeves and actually do it. You know, you start with the traditional stuff. There are 130 million Americans now who are members of co-ops. The most obvious form of democratizing ownership is conventional in the United States. And now it is expanding to worker ownership in many, many parts of the country. I was just at a conference in Puerto Rico. That's where they have co-op conferences there because it's really cheap in the summer. But there were dozens and dozens of new model worker-owned companies like New Era Window Company in Chicago. Many of you know about that, but the workers took over the company and they're now making it actually go. They've got a tremendous sales. People are buying from them and they own the company. There's, in Ohio, there is a really interesting set of co-ops, worker-owned co-ops in Cleveland, where there's an integrated set of worker co-ops based on the Mondragon model from the Basque country of Spain, where there's one of them is the largest cooperatively, it's the largest actual greenhouse in the United States, urban greenhouse, produces 3 million heads of lettuce a year. And there's another one, the solar company, and there's another one that's an industrial scale laundry in Cleveland, linked together with a cooperative nonprofit corporation so that the profits actually help the community as well. And a revolving fund to build more and more co-ops as they go forward. And also interesting, using some of the funds, those of you who think about models and how systems are designed, using some public funds to support and purchase from the worker-owned co-ops that are linked together to build community. public funds in hospitals and universities, in that case, Case Western Reserve, Cleveland Clinic, building and using that power which comes from Medicare, Medicaid, education money, and actually supporting a new form of decentralized collective ownership in the heart of Cleveland. 10 cities around the country are trying to replicate that model, and about 100 are looking into trying to do it, but 10 are actually doing it already. Why are they doing it? Why is new eras happening? Why are these models like the Cleveland co-ops beginning? Because people are being forced by the failures of the system to act in new ways, or the pain continues. That's what I mean by the context forcing people to wake up, either in terms of attitudes. People the percentages who say they'd rather have socialism than capitalism, or in practice actually doing it. Take another example. There are, in fact, 10,000 worker-owned companies in the United States. Most people don't know that because the establishment press doesn't report on it. 3 million more workers are involved in worker-owned companies that are members of unions in the United States. The biggest, if you take all the credit unions together, what's a credit union? A one person, one vote, socialized bank. Most of them are boring and staid and conservative, but some of those are beginning to change, and some activists are getting involved in that. But if you take them all together, they have more capital than any of the big New York banks. And they are one person, one vote, democratized ownership of capital. And what's happening, interesting, in some parts of the country, activists have realized, hey, public bank is part of the next system. Credit unions could be a public bank. It's already democratized. They're pretty boring right now. Not all of them, but most of them. Nobody ever goes to the annual meeting.
You should go.
You can be a member, and you can take over that board. And several places around the country are beginning to elect people to the board so they can use this source of gigantic source of capital in new ways. Very interesting development happening. That's in banking. You're going to hear more, I think, hear from Ellen Brown about public banking is exploding all over the country, like the state of North Dakota. How many know that the state of North Dakota has a public bank for 90 years, making a lot of money for the state and the taxpayers, and supported by the farmers, the co-ops, but even some of the conservatives? And 20 states have got legislation introduced and campaigns now to begin to develop public banking around the country. Why? Because people don't like the way the system is working, and they're beginning to actually look at changing the institutional structure. Not just the law, not just the policy, not just the government, not just who you elect, all of that's important, but actually saying, if you wanted to change the system, you're going to have to change the institutional structure and who gets to own the wealth and capital in a different way. And if it's to be a way we want, it's going to have to be democratized in real terms, building from the bottom up. So, public banking. So, worker-owned companies. So, co-ops. And in many other areas, land trusts, for instance, which are used sometimes for conservation. That's the old form. And in many cities, land trust is a public or quasi-public socialization of the land. And the reason you do it is to control land prices so you don't gentrify and force people out of neighborhoods. That idea, either by doing it through municipal ownership, which is also happening all over the country, the press doesn't cover it, or through nonprofit corporations controlled by neighborhoods, that idea 30 years ago was a non-starter. It was regarded as far too radical. There are 150 of them popping up in the last 10 years alone. Irvine, California is doing 5,000 units of housing. And it is another element actually socializing the land, really, in American cities, going on now by people who want to make a big change and are building the elements piece by piece of a decentralized, democratic, socialist format of one kind or another. I call it a pluralist commonwealth. Many different forms of ownership, land, utilities, public ownership, businesses, et cetera, different forms. But it's popping up because the pain levels don't give you an answer. And people are just beginning to realize they can do it themselves, and from that basis begin to generate a vision of where we might go over time. More on this. It's not only at the local and state level that the press doesn't cover what's happening. We've just passed the Obamacare legislation, And both the conservatives and liberals who write about it are correct that it will increase costs, that it will become very difficult to sustain, and the inevitable track over time is towards some single-payer form of health care. I'm for that, and we ought to cheer for it, but the thing to keep your eye on, in my opinion, is that there are forces that are forcing that direction and opening that door because the old system can't manage it. Vermont is first. It's going to be single-payer. It was passed twice in California and vetoed by Schwarzenegger, but the problem, Connecticut is on the verge of playing with it. The problem is that the system doesn't work, and it's not only that we want a better system. I mean, single payer is only the first step to socializing, really socializing in medical programs. It is that the system, what I'm trying to suggest to you is that we're living in a context where the very questions of how you actually change the system in a new way are being forced upon us, and we need to rise to the reality that this is real. You know, the healthcare system is almost 20% of the U.S. economy. And if you add the nonprofit sector, it's another 10% of the U.S. economy. And you start adding 10,000 worker-owned companies in the public bank, you begin to see the infrastructure like a picture in a photographer's darkroom slowly beginning to suggest a very American, very decentralized possibility of something new. You don't like to hear this, I suspect. Most people do not actually want to acknowledge the possibility. Ask yourself, are you really saying that we may be laying the foundations for a transformation? Really?
Yes.
Can you get that?
Yes.
Let it sit there and look at it. I'm suggesting something different to you. That people like the people who in this room and all of us are coming to this conference are really at that place in time where if we rise to the occasion, like those folks in Mississippi, and actually self-identify and are actually willing to grasp the possibility that we, I am talking to the person in your chair and the person standing here, that we actually can do that. That's where the power comes from. The problem is not the system. The problem is existential. It is whether we can actually rise to changing the system. Rather than... I'm for projects. I'm for confrontations. I'm for various forms of sit-ins, etc., elections, all of that. But if we can get to that place, the power then comes with us. Because we actually have a sense of the possibility of where we're going with all this. And for you utopians, did you notice we happened to nationalize General Motors, Chrysler, AIG, the biggest insurance company in the world? We still do own it, nationalize it. You can't nationalize companies in the United States. We just did it. Now, of course, at this point in our development, when they start making profits, with the taxpayer support, we sold them back. We still have AIG. But at some point down the line, if we keep building the base, keep developing the things that are developing around the communities, and the people begin to see democratizing ownership, co-ops, land trusts, public utilities, by 25% of American electricity is already socialized, public utilities and co-ops, that if we can begin to do this in different ways, it's kind of ordinary. Why in the hell give it back to those guys? I do not exclude that. I am not a utopian. I am a hard-headed, been-there-done-that political guy who's, you know, been in Washington for a long time. I'm also a historian. My own judgment, it is possible, let's be clear, that nothing can be done. That certainly is a possibility. Or just marginal changes. It's possible that the violence will occur, and there'll be a clampdown, and there will be a corporate state. That's also a possibility. The difficulties can create violence. There will be violence. We haven't yet seen it. And the question is what happens and how we deal with it and how we go beyond it. The pain levels are growing, particularly in the black and brown communities, but also white communities as well. And there will be clampdown. But that also, look to Latin America. That also is not the end of history. Those dictators are gone. That was not the end. Sometimes people get stopped by, there might be corporate state, maybe. It's also possible that the decay will simply continue. Decay. Decay. Stagnation. Decay. Rome did decay. But it is also possible, and I think likely, for the reasons I've just begun to sketch, and if we had time, we'd go more and more on, that we actually, in a very down-home American way, I just really want to stress that, this is not France, down-home American way, we get out and do it locally and build in the States. That's one of the best things about this country. There is a tradition of let's roll up our sleeves and do it. You don't find this kind of stuff in many other countries in the way you do in America. A lot of other good things in other countries. But the centralization, now here, I put on my political science hat. Paradoxically, because the welfare state has gone so much further in England and France and Germany, wish we had it, they have not got this possibility. Paradoxically, because we are incomplete, because the decay has continued, because the pain is growing, because the difficulties are here, we are being forced, for better or worse, and I think in some ways better, to begin to create a different alternative in a new way. We may lead the world revolution in this respect, in my opinion, not follow, while they keep dickering with the dying welfare state. I think Lydia mentioned that I am a historian of foreign policy, but particularly nuclear weapons. I came to this set of questions. I'm a historian of bombing Hiroshima. Yesterday was the anniversary. 2 days from now it would be Nagasaki. The drone war is not new. 300,000 people in one shot, boom. And what kind of a system, this is the question I come in with, and I think we all have, is it that would do that? What is the nature of a system that would continue to see violence of that kind, and now drones, as necessary? In part, it had to do with the culture that we allowed ourselves to build, which doesn't build community from the ground up. We don't build and haven't allowed ourselves to build community as a culture. That's why the decentralized, build from the bottom, co-ops, etc., is really important. Either we build community or we see them as objects to bomb. And we didn't. The culture has not built that kind of consciousness. But also, and this is still going on, our policymakers and our corporations and most Americans believe somehow that we have to manage the world economy in the nature of support for the economy, by which we mean corporate capitalism. And if we let it get out of hand in the Middle East, where there's oil over there, or the markets of Asia, or what's going on in the Pacific, if we let it get out of hand, somehow we're in trouble. That idea is now over 100 years old. And it was in part for that reason, I would suggest, that the bombs were dropped in Hiroshima. They all knew the war was over and didn't need an invasion. Every major general, including Eisenhower, is on record saying publicly that the bombing was totally unnecessary. But the policymakers wanted to do something. They weren't bad people. They wanted to build the world economy in a way that they thought would work, which meant solve the problem of corporate capitalism in the global economy. They call it globalization now. And they wanted to make sure the Russians didn't bother them, and they wanted to be sure the Russians didn't bother them, and they wanted to show that we had enough power. There's a long story, but it's not a very pretty story. The bottom line is, they were right. If this system doesn't expand, capitalist system, it gets in trouble. So either you actually manage the world in a way that allows you to continue to make it work, or you're in trouble. The converse is a system that actually doesn't need to do that is a system in which public management allows and stabilizes rather than having to grow, and capture new markets and set up new regulations, and now in the Pacific. So I come to this as to how do we build a system that doesn't have to expand, and with it the foreign policy that kills and kills and kills. I think the two things that about that are really striking also. One of the most interesting things about the war system, aside from its murderous nature, is it is in decline as well. Military spending peaked at 14% of the GDP in the Korean War. It averaged 10% of the GDP in the 50s. It was 8.8% in the 60s. It was 7.6% in the 70s. It is now on the way to 2 to 3.3%, depending upon what happens over the next 2 years. The pressures, even now, of being able to send more men to kill are actually constraining the military system, bad and dangerous as it is. That system is declining, even though it is causing more and more trouble. Nobody wants right now to send more kids off to Vietnam, to Afghanistan or Vietnam or Iraq. And the actual drone is an excuse because they can't get the support to do the wars. There's going to be a lot more pain before that system dwindles. But I want to suggest to you that we are actually in the process of decaying that system. Stand back for a minute. What is our task here? Is it possible that this system is in decay, really? That it is causing people great pain, really? That experimentation, like the prehistory of the New Deal, like the women's movement in the 19th century, like the civil rights people in Mississippi in the 30s, that kind of prehistory is in fact developing the elements step by step, co-op, by credit union, by public sector bank, by healthcare system, by maybe some nationalizations on maybe beginning to build the precondition, the elements of the next system? I think the answer is certainly real possibility. In my view, likely, over time, and if not on this round, when the next failure continues, the next round, and beyond to and through the difficulties. I don't think they can pull it together or manage it. And I think most people are beginning to realize they can't pull it together and manage it. And as that continues, it offers us not only the possibility, but I think a brutal challenge. The challenge is to people who would come to a conference like this and to actually put together the extraordinary wealth of information. The challenge is, can we both confront and build, confront and build, confront and build, and then can we learn and teach, learn and teach? I think we have the opportunity, and probably the responsibility, and the existential necessity of rising to the question of whether we are actually historical actors, willing to see ourselves as really building the next system, even as we do the projects, even as we do the actions, even as we do the local democracy, actually beginning to say at each time, reevaluating, are we actually rising to the possibility of this moment in history? I don't think people would be in this room or at this conference if they didn't in their hearts feel, yes, that's the answer. And I'm very pleased to be able to be with you.